ุทธังธัมมังสังฆังนมัสสามิOne of the most often commented upon teachings from the Buddha is from a conversation that was taking place regarding friendship, where the Buddha placed very great emphasis on what he referred to as kalyanamitta, or beautiful friendship. And there are many occasions, not just that one conversation, where the Buddha spoke in praise of building, cultivating, maintaining spiritual friendship, the benefit of spiritual friendship. A discourse on great auspiciousness, which you probably know, the Mahamangala Sutta, the first two lines of the first stanza. The first one is, don't associate with those that are going to pull you down. The second line, associate with those who are going to lift you up. Panditana chasevana, associate with those who are going to lift you up. That's the gist of what's being said. Keep company with those who are going to have a good effect on you. And this is the teachings that he gave to the monks specifically and to lay people, and encouraging very strongly this aspect of the spiritual life, to emphasize developing these friendships and understanding what friendships that are conducive with this spiritual journey look like, feel like, and how to maintain them. Dhammapada verse 328, if you find a good companion of integrity and wisdom, overcome all dangers in their joyous and caring company. And then, also, there's the emphasis the Buddha placed on solitude and spending time alone. The benefits of being away from lots of activity and talking. And for some people, maybe it would appear that there's a conflict there. Though I would suggest that there doesn't have to be a conflict. And it's one reason why I thought it would be good to talk about it this evening. That there doesn't need to be a conflict between the Buddha's encouragement to spend time alone, to value aloneness, and enjoy the benefit of being alone, and to enjoy the benefit of beautiful friendships. In my own observation of how these things work, the emphasis that I place on in the training given in this monastery to the young monks who live here, our interest in spending time alone is suitable when it's born out of a sense of ability to be with others. Not really, at least for Westerners, this interest in solitary practice is born out of a feeling of inadequacy. I remember when I lived in Thailand, I forget who it was who mentioned it to me, though they pointed out that the setup of the monastery, Wat Pa Phong, Ajahn Chah's main monastery, where you could walk around the forest in one meditation hut to another meditation hut, you could hardly ever see one from the other. You're completely alone. And the Thai monks really didn't like that. The Thais are very community-based people, and they enjoy each other's company. Westerners, it seemed, apparently, loved the solitude. They thought, whippy, this is great, I don't have to see anybody. And that's interesting, what's going on there? Well, it seems to be that what's going on there is sometimes it's the case that people seek solitude out of unaddressed pain that has arisen in the context of relationships and early stages of life. And it's not rare, at least again in Western society, that By the time we're 20, 24, 25, 26, many of us have already accumulated a backlog of denied pain, denied dukkha around relationships. It's guaranteed there's going to be misunderstanding and misperceptions happen in relationship, whether it's the close relationships with our family or with our friends or at school or with our teachers, and misunderstandings, misperceptions, hurt happens. And how do we deal with it? And do we deal with it in the context of relationship? Do we sort it out with each other? Or do we avoid it? And it seems to me that one of the side effects, unexpected, unhelpful side effects of affluence, is the opportunities for distraction are enormous now. And so it's the case that I would suggest, particularly in the high-tech age and social media, and people spending time alone on their computers, that instead of developing the skills of working through the normal upsets and disappointments that life gives us, the minor and the intense upsets that life gives us, instead of working through them in the context of relationships, a lot of us turn away from that dukkha, turn away from that pain. And so turning away from relationships becomes the norm. And so I'm raising this here because some people, I think, read the Buddha's teachings on aloneness, like that Dhammapada verse, Atahiyata no nato kohinato parosiya. Oneself is one's own refuge. How could it be otherwise? Or how could anybody else be your refuge? And, oh, right. Oneself is one's own refuge. Okay, I'm going to live on my own. Live by myself. Not have anything to do with anybody else. Goodbye, cruel world. And even though that may not be the conscious thought patterns that are occurring, it could be happening on an unconscious level. The idea that relationships are a problem, that other people are the problem. This isn't what the Buddha taught. The challenge, the dukkha, is what? It's how we relate to the activity in our hearts, how we relate to how we feel when we're hurt in relationships. Do we have the readiness? Do we feel supported? Do we feel able to really meet ourselves there and accept ourselves in the midst of our struggle? Or do we reject ourselves? Not only do we reject ourselves, it often happens, we project that out and we reject others and we blame others. And so I would suggest that this is the norm for many people. They find it difficult to live with others, and including people who join monasteries. Mm. And that's not to be encouraged. And so, as I was saying, the training in this monastery here, the first 5, 6, 7 years of training, the emphasis is on learning to live together, to cooperate. Like the example in the scriptures of Anuruddha and his companions, the Buddha spoke about them living together, blending like milk and water, just blending effortlessly, and caring about each other. Even though they're very highly attained monks, all of them, they were putting a lot of effort into paying attention to each other. The one that came back from alms round first would prepare the seating places for the others, and then those that finished the meal last would clear up, and so on. And paying attention to harmonious, cooperative living is a beautiful and nourishing way to live. And so that's the motivation, I would suggest, that we need to be coming from when we decide we're going to spend time in solitude or in silence, and coming from a place of ability, not inability. Now, that doesn't mean to say that we shouldn't spend time on our own until we've got everything sorted. That's definitely not what I'm saying. In fact, 1 week each month, or most months of the year anyway, in this monastery, 1 week we designate as silent practice week. And we pull back from all the work projects and the external activities and spend a week in, or 6 days usually is, in quietude. And then from time to time, the monks, the samaniras, and the anagarikas do ask to spend time in the meditation huts down by the lake and spend time in solitude, and I heartily encourage and support that to a degree. So I see that solitary practice is like working out in the gym, like people go to the gym to work out, to build up some muscles, and to stay fit. Though you don't live in the gym. Well, occasionally there's a few perhaps professionals who spend every day in the gym, or maybe some people actually live in the gym. Majority of people don't spend all day in the gym. They go there to work out, and likewise, the majority of people living in solitude is not the norm. It's something that we do to put ourselves under pressure so as to be able to look deeper, so as to be able to feel more accurately where, when, and how is it that we're hanging on to conditions in a way that is creating suffering. So there's a time for it, absolutely. However, the motivation to be in solitude, to be silent, is ideally coming from a place of ability and not running away from other people because we can't stand them. So getting back to the theme of cultivating beautiful friendships, the Buddha, as it had a lot to say about it, the benefits of it, and what you could learn from association with those who've walked the path ahead of us and know more than us and have cultivated great virtue. And he also spoke about the characteristics of such a good friend. And one of these lists, the first thing he mentions, is that such a good friend will point out things to us that are difficult to point out, will say things that are not easy to hear. And that's interesting. Part of us might like to think that a really good friend is just somebody who is always accommodating and saying nice things to us. Well, that's not the perspective of the Buddha. Quite the opposite, saying that actually a good friend is willing and able to say things that are difficult to hear. It might be something as mundane and everyday as like telling your friend that their breath is smelling bad. And it's not something you want to point out to somebody, but yeah, if somebody's breath is smelling bad and they don't know about it, well, that's unfortunate. And, well, a friend will tell them. And it could be something a lot more difficult to hear, like, for instance, if you have an unfortunate habit of exaggerating the truth, which like these days is very normal in society, and deceitfulness, unfortunately, in various ways, including in speech, is tolerated, is even accepted, in some cases, and considered as normal, which is not the case. And it's very unfortunate, deceitful habits of speech. And if you have developed such a habit, a good friend is somebody who would find the right time, right place, right words to mention it. Say, are you aware that this seems to be happening? Willing and able to give difficult feedback are all the characteristics of a good friend. Another characteristic of a truly good friend is somebody who respects confidentiality. Because everybody has memories and experiences of not having handled life very well and benefit from being able to share that with somebody else. And in cases where that's appropriate, that confidence is respected. And they also are willing to share in a trusting way, being trusting in our relationships, that when somebody shares something with us that it's appropriate to keep confidential, that we're willing and able to do that. And one way of measuring it, if you've been told something and you feel tempted to repeat it, is to stop and reflect, would the person who told me this be happy that I'm sharing this? And to stop and reflect on that. Also on this list, the Buddha talks about how a beautiful friend doesn't ignore you when you're suffering. There are such friends who, when we struggle, when we're having a hard time, they disappear. They just want to be around when times are good. A truly good friend doesn't leave us when we're struggling, and also doesn't judge us when we're suffering. So these are qualities or characteristics of a good friend from the Buddhist perspective, and something that we can, for instance, consider when we're thinking about our friends. And is this person a real friend, or do they just say nice things to me all the time, for instance? And consider with regards to ourselves, am I a truly good friend to this person? Am I a good friend or not? And if we find a good friend, to really value that, to not make the unfortunate mistake of taking friends for granted, something that the casual culture means that we regularly take our good fortune for granted. So similar to if you break an arm, and break your wrist, and you can't use it, and it's so difficult to not have your right arm to write with and lift things with. Oh, when my arm is healed, I'll be so happy, I'll be so grateful. And then when your arm is healed, it's no time at all before you take it for granted again. It's a risk. We take our good fortune for granted, and the values of the casual culture we live in tend to take us in that direction. And so let's not do that with our friends. Let's be careful, let's value our friends, not taking them for granted. Friends should be seen as like house plants. If you don't water them, then they wither and die. And if you do water them, if you look after them, they can be beautiful. So cultivating beautiful friendship is as an aspect of our spiritual life. It's not just a matter of making sure we get up in the morning and spend 20, 30, 40 minutes in meditation. That's important indeed. Also, remembering the emphasis the Buddha put on cultivating beautiful friendship, valuing beautiful friendship, benefiting from it. Another way of developing such friendship, I would suggest, is looking at the four Brahma Viharas, the four divine abidings, and the people with whom we can share the four Brahma Viharas, the four divine abidings, metta, karuna, mudita, upekkha, to be able to share in intentional well-wishing for another being, intentional well-wishing for ourselves, intentional well-wishing, that ability to consciously wish well. Like in the Karaniya Metta Sutta, so with a boundless heart should one cheer us who are living beings. There's potentially boundless quality the Buddha was pointing out, and using the example of a mother with her only child, the selflessness of a mother with her only child, that willing to sacrifice herself, even her life, for the sake of the child, that beautiful selflessness, to intentionally develop that with another human being, wishing them well. How do we do that? Well, it's much more than just thinking nice thoughts. It requires a daring to allow vulnerability, daring to feel caring. I've been speaking about recently about the open-hearted state. For many of us, again, the unacknowledged pain in life contributes to a contraction, an actual physical feeling of contraction in the heart, and the energy is not flowing anymore. There's not a lot of awareness, not a lot of aliveness in the heart center. And to really consciously care for others maybe is not going to happen if we are obstructed in the area. So it can be daring, because to open up in that way is vulnerable. We have to be able to feel vulnerable if we want to truly wish beings be well in a feeling way, not just have nice thoughts about people. And that, so don't be surprised if the practice of cultivating metta, or conscious caring practice, is not necessarily easy. And the cultivation of compassion or empathy in the context of suffering, to feel sadness in the company of somebody who is sad, to feel it in the chest, in the heart, and not be crushed by it. If we haven't prepared ourselves, if we haven't exercised the cultivation of open-hearted awareness, and we're compulsively contracted, then even if we do open up in the context of suffering with an interest to share in that way with somebody, what we're likely to encounter is our own backlog of denied pain, and we risk being overwhelmed by it, threatened by it. And then one way of reacting is to judge it as somehow going wrong and perceive this other person as going wrong and try and fix them, rather than simply being there with them and empathizing. We try and fix them, we make them wrong and say you shouldn't be suffering. When we're suffering, people try and fix us, they think they're being kind, when really often what's happening is it's an aversion for the experience of suffering. So it's a skill to be able to feel the hurt of life, the sadness of life, without contracting around it and saying it shouldn't be this way, and then projecting it out and saying the world shouldn't be this way, other people shouldn't be this way. Can we do the opposite and open and expand our heart, take a deep breath, a very deep full breath, and with the intention of accommodating the pain of the world, to see the chaos, to feel sad without being defined by the sadness? From a conceptual point of view, you say, well, what good's that going to do? Well, I would suggest it frees us from some obstructions. If we are so obstructed in capacity for feeling kindness or compassion, that actually we're not discerning clearly. Our discernment faculty is obstructed and limited. We're not living in relationship with other human beings. We're living in ideas of other human beings. So daring to feel the sorrow of life with others, compassion. And mudita, daring to feel the joy of life, empathy in the context of joy. I think this is particularly challenging for men. Men tend to be afraid of that sensitivity where you delight in the well-being of others. There's so much what's called banter, where they're actually not allowing empathy to inform the relationship. They're making jokes about it, and sometimes cynicism, sarcasm, rather than being nourished by that particular form of beauty that the Buddha referred to as mudita. You know, closing down and going up to the head and coming up with some story, and then the energy comes out through the mouth in some sort of unfortunate expression of pain. So, talking about in this way is not, I hope, doesn't sound depressing. Rather, these qualities of metta, karuna, mudita that the Buddha talked about as the divine abidings are sources of beauty, sources of joy, sources of nourishment, which warrant cultivation. If we turn to them and we find we feel unable in that area, well then, that's what I'm pointing to. Why is it? What's going on there? And one way of understanding what's going on there is that we've closed down. We closed down in the department where we feel kindness and compassion and empathetic joy. And it can be work to open up again. It can take a daring attitude. Also, it's important in this contemplation of the divine abidings to remember the Buddha's teachings on equanimity, upekkha. The first three of these four divine abidings and the boundless qualities, and so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. We're talking talking about conscious caring or the boundless, selfless compassion of the Buddha. With upekkha, with equanimity, we're talking about boundedness, limitations, and the reflection that we're encouraged to cultivate or to use in the cultivation of equanimity is that I am the owner of my karma, heir to my karma, born of my karma, related to my karma, abide supported by my karma, whatever karma I shall do, for good or for ill, of that I will be the heirs. And all beings are the owners of their karma, heir to their karma, and so on. That there are limitations to what we can do. We are limited. Even the Buddha said, all the Buddha can do is point the way. The Buddha can't enlighten us. The Buddha can't save us. The Buddha can't rescue us. What the Buddha can do is point the way. And likewise, in our cultivation of these beautiful qualities, or the cultivation of beautiful friendships, there are inherent limitations. We may indeed care for people, wish them well, have empathy in the context of suffering, have empathy in the context of joy. However, some relationships need to be willing to accept, oh, there are limitations. I'm responsible for the intentional actions that I perform with body, speech and mind. I'm responsible for this. And other beings, they're responsible for their intentional actions of body, speech and mind. So that's a few words, or quite a lot of words actually, on the subject of cultivating beautiful friendship. And maybe it's too many words, however I hope that it's helpful. And in terms of practice, if one last suggestion I'd like to share with you is that if you want to be a good friend for somebody, just one thing that we can cultivate, we can all cultivate, is the ability to listen. Quietly listening is a gift of friendship. Most of us carry the pain of not really having been seen, not having been heard truly, genuinely. And so it's a gift to offer to somebody if we prepare ourselves, train our attention so that when somebody is talking with us, instead of being up in our heads and thinking, oh, this person wants me to solve their problems, what am I going to say? And we might have such ideas floating around. However, we can also train ourselves, imagine, I intentionally imagine that my ears are in the center of my chest, sometimes, not always, but I have done. I think it's a good exercise to imagine that your ears are right in the center of your chest, listening from that place. Whatever views, opinions, and noise are going on in our head. Just it's like, yeah, it's just the sound of what's going on in our head. Just let it be there. You don't have to try and stop it. Rather, spend time feeling what we feel when we're in the company of others, listening as a gift, as an offering of friendship. Thank you very much for your attention.